RCR with Paul Brennan, Reality Check Radio.
All right, let's talk about a newly released study published in the New Zealand Medical Journal, revealing the rates of puberty blocker prescriptions in New Zealand. And on RCR again to talk about this is Jan Rivers, founder of Public Good and spokeswoman for GenSpect New Zealand. And Jan was on our political panel just a few days ago as well. Jan, nice to have you back. Thanks for coming on again.
Thank you very much. I think looks like I'm becoming a regular face.
Oh, yeah. Whether you like it or not. Okay.
Yeah. Anyway, so shall I tell you a little bit about the study?
Please do.
Yeah. The title was The Use of Puberty Blocking Hormones for Gender Dysphoria in New Zealand, Descriptive Analysis and International Comparisons. Mm. Co-authored by three people. The principal author is Charlotte Ball, Emeritus Professor from Otago Med School. And in the research, they took the data from New Zealand, which is only available from Pharmac, and there's a bit of detail to what they had to do, but they then compared it with the Netherlands and with England and Wales. And they found that in England and Wales, there was between 3.5 and 6.9 times the cumulative incidence of prescribing. So quite a serious multiplier over what was happening in the UK. And yep. In the Netherlands, which is regarded as having the most careful approach to prescribing, 1.7 times the cumulative incidence. Previously, we'd thought that it was about 10 times, but what we were doing there was looking at the data for 1 year. I think it was like 2021 in England and Wales and in New Zealand. And of course, when I was a little bit involved in this, we weren't doing some of this really smart analysis that these people have done. So for example, one of the things that they did was that you can prescribe puberty blocking medication for a number of different issues. Mm. And Pharmac doesn't actually tell you what the prescription was used for. They just tell you that it's been prescribed and also the age of the person to whom it was prescribed. And so what the researchers did was to take prescriptions that were made between 12 years and 17 years of age. And the reason they did that is because younger children could possibly be being treated either for very short stature or for a relatively unusual condition called precocious puberty, which is when they go into puberty at the age of maybe 7, 8, 9, earlier than usual. For example, women who are being prescribed it maybe have endometriosis. The men who are being described that are probably suffering from prostate cancer.
Yeah. Are we talking older men there or men of all ages?
Typically, they would be older men.
Yeah, of course they would be. Yeah.
Late middle age. Yeah, that's right.
Okay, so this precocious puberty, mm-hmm. which puberty blockers, I think, were originally prescribed for long before gender dysphoria, let's say, which I think started in the Netherlands.
That's right. Prescribing started
in the Netherlands. So we have them to thank for that. You would think that that would have stayed, unless there's something in the water, pretty well static over the years, right, in terms of how many people get hit with this as kids, mainly girls, females, right? So you wouldn't expect to see a huge ballooning of that necessarily unless there's been some environmental change or, like I say, something in the water. So I think can we assume that the proportion of those receiving puberty blockers for that condition has pretty well stayed the same over the years?
That there has been a slight increase and for reasons that people don't know. And of course, what that means is that the gross number of children or the total number of children on puberty blockers will be greater than the research was able to show. But for the purposes of being absolutely clear that they weren't introducing data that was potentially unhelpful, I imagine that's why they have done what they've done, which is to exclude any children who could possibly be being prescribed for short stature or for precocious puberty.
So we can assume then the growth has all been around gender dysphoria.
I think that's absolutely would be the case, yes. Those are the only... And the other thing is that for precocious puberty, not for short stature, the drug companies state that that is a purpose of these drugs, whereas for gender dysphoria, they say that they're not, that isn't some expression like a permitted indication, which means that the drug has been tested and used against that particular medical condition. That's not the case for gender dysphoria.
Well, that's interesting because ivermectin wasn't allowed to be used to treat COVID, worked for a whole lot of parasitical problems in Africa. So one rule for one and another rule for another, it seems. So you can appropriate a medication in this area, even though it has not been recommended or anything, even the design of it has had anything to do with treating gender dysphoria.
One of the things which would have been good had the New Medicines Act come into place, I think it was called the Therapeutic Products Act, was that clinicians would have become a legal requirement that a clinician had to make a diagnosis in order to provide a treatment. And that would have posed some problems for the people in the Wild West of New Zealand's gender medicine because they don't make a diagnosis. They say that they can't make a diagnosis. They have simply to be guided by the child's own perceptions, which is unique in medicine.
Yeah. Well, that gives you a free pass. That gives you the ultimate out and actually puts it back on the poor child. How dare they do that to a child?
Yes. Yeah. I mean, we're in an interesting situation in New Zealand because of the way they use a thing called Gillick competency, which is a sort of technical term which arose from a court case in the UK. And it was about the idea of when children were able to provide informed consent. And that was the thing that was a large part of the Keira Bell case. I don't know if you recall I think 2020, 2019, 2020. And it was decided that young people, even up to the ages of 16 and 17, were not necessarily really able to understand the long-term impacts of gender medicine on their ongoing health and fertility.
Yeah.
So,
I'd go along with that. Okay, so what does the data show? From the quick look at the graphs, here's my impression. That you saw a steady growth that would track with the building enthusiasm of the sector to promote this way of medication and all of that. And we see some quite big jumps, and then we see it drop all of a sudden. So what do you make of and also, let's be really clear, most of what's being prescribed is to females. That's the other thing that comes through very clearly.
That's right. And I mean, if I can just make an aside before I talk to your question, one of the things which is incredibly unusual about this condition is that if you suddenly had a 5 or 10-fold increase in any illness over a very short period of time, what you would do would be to start to look at the causes or the possible reasons why that was happening. But in the case of gender medicine, the people who are advocating this are just behaving as if, oh, well, this is just caused by people's increasing ability to be who they really are. And if you look at that claim, it really doesn't stand up to analysis. So that's the first thing, that there's an extreme lack of curiosity about really looking at what's going on with this medication. And the second thing, which I remembered by attending the GenSpec conference at the weekend, is that it used to be that research would report the number of these children, I mean, not the very young ones, but the ones who had declared same-sex attraction. And the numbers are very high, you know, up to 70 or 80% of kids who go on to cross-sex hormones and puberty blockers are same-sex attracted. So basically what you're looking at is conversion therapy from same-sex attracted people to transition. Mm. So that's the first thing.
Well, the way the figures tracked, you can almost see I call it a social contagion, the building social contagion effect of mainly young females being prescribed this medication, building to a sort of like a crescendo, if you will, and then it suddenly dropping, like the wind's gone out of its sails. I'm curious about that. I'm sure you've got an opinion on that. But the numbers seem to track with the intuitive feeling that this is a building kind of fad that can't last. But unfortunately, females are taking the hit.
Young women absolutely are taking the hit. And yes, the writers, of course, couldn't be specific about or you know, could only speculate about the reasons and do what they usually do, which is call for more research, you know, when you've got an area where you've got insufficient information. But I wonder if the reason that the wind is slightly being taken out of the sails of this increase is what's been happening in the UK and the fact that parents whose children might be reporting that they feel uncomfortable with their bodies or that they're a different gender are being a little bit more sceptical about the prospects because they will have seen the news from the UK and elsewhere in the world. And the other reason may be that quite a lot of our doctors, GPs, have worked for a period in the UK and they would be very well aware that if they were to be prescribing puberty blockers in the UK at the moment, they would be breaking the law.
Yeah.
And so I guess, but those two sort of, you know, we don't know to the extent either of those are having an impact, but those would be my best guesses.
Yeah. How could you explain it any other way? The only other way to explain it is there's been a sudden drop off in gender dysphoria. And that's only a recent phenomenon. And I think you made the point that that's connected to the affirmation process anyway, you know?
I mean, there's the terminology around gender medicine has changed rapidly over the last decade as people who are activists have seen what they regard as implied criticisms of them. And so even the most subtle language has been changed in order to be affirming. So, for example, gender dysphoria was previously called something else, you know, gender. The term was something like gender misalignment, you know, something. Yeah. I can't remember the term.
Misalignment.
Sorry, I'm not being very.
No, but why not call it that? Yeah.
Yeah. Mm. One of the really difficult things for me is that young people by being regarded as actually being transgender or gender diverse. And it seems to me that that's a huge leap to assume that somebody who is gender distressed, which is a very, very common factor, is actually somebody who's transgender. And the other issue around this is that gender diverse means whatever you want it to mean. It means A, somebody who's transgender, or it means B, somebody who feels that their body doesn't align exactly with the social standards for how it is to be male and female in our society. So if your body doesn't feel like it matches the stereotypes, then that's regarded as a problem, whereas in fact, we should regard it as a welcome aspect of human diversity.
Yeah, and to use that as, I mean, again, how can 12, 13-year-olds discern the complicated emotional architecture of a person going through all sorts of pressures that are being imposed unless you want, that's the control mechanism, to inflict this sort of stuff on people? And that's where it gets really dark for me because that's child abuse. Actually, to me, pure and simple. I could be missing something here, but when you strip it down, you know?
Yeah, thank you. There's a couple of aspects of that. One of them, there was some research released yesterday, and it was about the extent to which young men are using extreme body modification, not because they think they're transgender, but because they think they don't measure up at the gym. So we've got we've got this underlying move towards body modification. And of course, it's like potentially a huge market for drug companies. And on top of that, we've got gender confusion, gender dysphoria. And they're all kind of heading in the same direction towards more intrusive approaches to looking after our bodies. And then the other thing, which I think is really important, is that young people are necessarily going to have a stereotyped impression of what it means to be a man or a woman. They simply have to look at the media. They have to look at how people are presented in advertising. They have to look at toys, you know, all of those things. Like, toys didn't used to be gendered in the same way that they are again now. And so young people are highly attentive and highly attuned to whether they fit into those very divided categories in a way that as they used to grow older, did not, they became aware that there were other options of how to be an adolescent boy or an adolescent girl, or how to be a man or a woman, available to them, which provided them with much more leeway to behave differently.
Yeah. And don't underestimate, because I've seen this firsthand, the vicarious nature of some parents who like to live vicariously through their gender dysphoric son or daughter, and the status that that can give, or that people can perceive that gives them. Don't underestimate that. That is part of it too.
That is a factor, certainly. But you also can't limit the idea that a lot of parents are told that it's almost their duty to affirm their child, and that harm will come to them if they don't affirm their child. And of course, it's turning out that those warnings are absolutely untrue. The evidence doesn't show that children have worse mental health if they don't get social transition or be put onto puberty blockers. But I'm afraid the medics who are working in this area are slightly behind the evidence on this.
And just to finish up, the way Pharmac record those statistics, I mean, it kind of defies common sense that you wouldn't divide up the uses for these prescription puberty blockers, so you know actually what they are being used for. It seems like there might be an element of willful blindness in the way that is carried out, so you don't actually have to say, because that's the crucial information right there, isn't it, in the end?
I think it's not so much that Pharmac is to blame for not doing this. They're the drug supplier, after all. I think that there are our health system is huge and complex with many, many working parts. And where the responsibility lies for particular aspects of how it's all run is quite carefully determined between the different parts of the whole apparatus.
Right.
And so the real issue is that the people who work in gender medicine always say, but we would welcome more research. We would welcome more research, they say. But there are dozens of people in the academic system within New Zealand who are employed to do research on transgender medicine and transgender health. And you know what's surprising? Does any of that research ever get requested or funded or commissioned? Do any of those people actually carry out the research that would show that what they're doing is effective? And the answer is that there is no such research. In fact, if such research were proposed, it would likely become very unpopular. I mean, there are various examples in other countries where there's been attempts to suppress research information. And I was just looking recently at a piece of research which was on the mental effects of taking puberty blockers. And that research showed that if you give puberty blockers to twin sheep, the sheep that has been treated is still, after a year after the treatment, unable to navigate its way around its living area as effectively as the untreated sheep. Yep. Children who are given puberty blockers have a 10-point loss in IQ before and after treatment. The woman who tried to get that research published had to approach three different journals that would be precisely the kind of places that you would expect to have the research published. And it was only, I think, on the fourth attempt that she was able to get the research published.
Yep.
Yeah, so there's not a lot of keenness to do this research, even though there is lip service to the idea that, oh, it would be a good idea if the research were to be done.
Oh, it's not going to turn out too well for some people later on, I have a feeling.
I think you're right.
Yeah.
I think things are moving extremely quickly in the rest of the world. And there are now something like 20 legal cases going on that I'm aware of. And the same availability of the law to rein in some of this doesn't exist in New Zealand. But I can't help believing that the ramifications of this will very soon be having an effect. We only need, a young person or a parent to take a judicial review here, as we did in the UK earlier.
Yeah.
To have that effect.
And do you think it's reasonable to say that we'll see a downward trend in those prescription statistics now or reports? I think we will, won't we?
I suspect that the downward trend will continue.
Hmm.
And there is a term which is being used in the rest of the world, even where the law isn't making, or the policy isn't making puberty blockers illegal. And it's sort of like quiet quitting is the term that's been used.
Yeah, that tells you everything you need to know. All right, we were discussing their newly released study published in the Medical Journal of New Zealand revealing the rates of puberty blocker prescriptions in New Zealand. And Jan Rivers, founder of Public Good and spokeswoman for GenSpec NZ. Thanks for coming on again, Jan. It's so fascinating, but it's so sad too, I find. You know, I really do. My heart breaks almost.
Very sad indeed, yes. And thank you again for the opportunity.
Are you on the RCR mailing list? Never miss a beat of the news and hard-hitting stories you've come to know and love. Stay in the loop. Visit realitycheck.radio/email.